This audio presentation was pre-recorded and edited for brevity and clarity.
Hello, I'm Michael Buckley, and welcome to the November 2020 Bright Focus Chat. Today's chat is entitled Future Hope for Geographic Atrophy. Let me tell you about today's guest speaker. His name is Dr. Benjamin Kim. He is an assistant professor of ophthalmology at the University of Pennsylvania's Medical School in Philadelphia, and he also sees patients as an ophthalmologist in the Penn Medical System. And we're very proud through the generosity of our donors to have the chance to work with Dr. Kim over the years as he's worked on better understanding and treating age-related macular degeneration. And hopefully we'll have a chance to hear about some of that work today. So Dr. Kim, welcome to the Bright Focus Chat. Just wondering if you could just start off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. First, I do want to thank you, Michael, for inviting me to participate in this really terrific series for patients. I appreciate the opportunity. So I've been at the University of Pennsylvania now for 8 years, and as you said, I'm involved in both patient care and research. I do actually spend about 75% of my time seeing patients, many of whom do have age-related macular degeneration. And then a quarter of my time, at least really more of that, if you include all the times at nights and weekends, is spent doing clinical research. And one of my ongoing strong research interests has been in the geographic atrophy form of macular degeneration. And I had recently completed a phase two smaller study in geographic atrophy, which turned out to have negative data. But was something involved in this field. And I also was the chair of the safety monitoring committee for the Apellis Pharmaceutical phase two study, which now has a drug that's in phase three clinical trials for geographic atrophy.
Great. Thank you for sharing your background and kind of the career day type of question. How did you end up in the fields of science and medicine?
Right. Well, for me, it really was not a hard decision for me. Ever since I was young, I've always had an interest in science when I was in school, and my father was a primary care physician and still is practicing, and so I had a lot of exposure to the field of medicine. And as a career choice, I really just loved the ability to be involved in both medicine with patient care, but also science with the research that I've been involved in, because I love the ability to have a daily impact, positively impact patients on every day when you see patients and take care of them, but then also have the ability to get involved in medical research, which allows you to really have a broader, long-term scale opportunity to make a positive impact.
Well, that's great. It really sounds like an exciting balance between the patient care and a lot of the long-term research that you do with Bright Focus and others. And I know, most of us just generically talk about macular degeneration and sort of as an umbrella term, but could you tell us a little bit about a couple of the advanced stages of AMD, such as wet AMD and geographic atrophy? Like, how would you describe these two? Like, would they have similarities or what are their differences?
Sure. Many patients have heard these terms wet and dry AMD, and wet AMD is one of the advanced forms of macular degeneration where you develop abnormal blood vessels under the retina that can bleed and leak fluid, thereby damaging the retinal tissue and sometimes causing scarring and atrophy in the area. And this development of these blood vessels and the downstream ramifications of it lead to decreased vision for these patients. Geographic atrophy, on the other hand, is when you have what's referred to as atrophy or death of the cells that form the outer portions of the retinal tissue. And geographic atrophy is an advanced stage of dry AMD. And so there is no abnormal bleeding or leaking of blood vessels that you get in the wet form. And in contrast, you get these patches or geographic areas of cell loss that develop and that are associated with parts of the retina that do not function and cannot properly sense light or properly sense an image in that part of the retina.
Are there, is it possible somebody could have one form in one eye and a different form in the other eye?
Yes, it is. That's an interesting question. So you have some patients that do have both eyes with wet AMD and other patients that have both eyes with geographic atrophy. But then you can have patients that have the wet form in one eye and geographic atrophy in their other eye. And the exact reasons for that are not completely understood. Furthermore, you can actually have an eye with wet AMD that develops atrophy in the eye, which is in fact a major cause contributing to the vision loss in wet AMD eyes. And then you can also have eyes with geographic atrophy that convert to the wet form of macular degeneration. So there definitely is crossover, as well as one eye with wet and one eye with dry, that can happen.
Thanks. That's interesting. We get that question a lot here on the chats. In terms of the similarities and differences between wet AMD and geographic atrophy, are there treatments available for one or both of those forms of AMD?
Right. So for quite a while now, wet AMD has had a treatment that comes in the form of eye injections. Many patients have heard of them, and probably some of the patients on the line may be receiving these injections. But these treatments were a major breakthrough for the field of wet AMD treatment, because they really can stabilize the vision and in a good number of cases improve the vision. This is in contrast to geographic atrophy, which remains an incredible unmet need for our field. Geographic atrophy really is estimated by itself to still be causing around 20% of the legal blindness in North America, and there still is not a approved treatment for geographic atrophy. And so I consider it one of the highest priorities in the field of ophthalmology, finding a treatment for GA.
Wow. So that's a pretty startling statistic to hear, that it's 20% of the legal blindness in older populations. And, you know, kind of in your experience, are we getting better at diagnosing and managing geographic atrophy, you know, kind of in the absence of a treatment? Are we getting better at sort of understanding it and helping the patients along the way?
We are. I mean, I would say the diagnosis of geographic atrophy has not been that difficult as a clinician, but really what has been a challenge over the years and where we have made progress is just understanding more and more what is going on in geographic atrophy, what makes some lesions perhaps develop faster or grow faster than other lesions, the various mechanisms that could be at play. And it's turned out that as we've learned more, there certainly have been even more questions that have come up that remain to be answered as the next frontier in our understanding. But I think that it's been a long road of understanding geographic atrophy, and we really have started to make some progress. I know that seeing my patients with geographic atrophy, I do feel the weight of the conversations that I have with them when patients come in and tell me that they have lost more vision and are now unable to read or perform some of the daily tasks that they love to do, and the strong wish that really the patient and I feel that there should be a treatment that we can offer them. And so while it's been a long road of development for treatments for geographic atrophy, I really do think that now there are some really promising drugs in clinical trials that we can be hopeful for.
Well, that's great. Now, it gives us a great hope for the future, and we'll turn to an overview of some of those treatments in a moment. Before that, you know, there's the treatment side of the coin, and then there's the daily life, the lifestyle, exercise, diet, et cetera. Are there things that in lieu of a treatment that people can do with geographic atrophy that are in their best interest?
I do think there are things that people can do, and I think that especially preventative measures even before geographic atrophy can really be taken. I think that a healthy lifestyle, healthy diet cannot be underestimated, and we know, for example, smoking is an incredibly large risk factor for macular degeneration, and smoking cessation, you know, today for a patient can make a difference, we think, in the future changes in their macular degeneration. We know that what are called the AREDS vitamins, there are a lot of the patients on the line have heard of these vitamins, which are a antioxidant formulation studied by the National Eye Institute and found to be helpful for the intermediate stage of the disease. Those vitamins can potentially slow down development of advanced forms of macular degeneration and are worthwhile to take. And of course, regular eye exams, not forgetting that your ophthalmologist can pick up things in your eyes before you may notice a change in vision. And so there are certainly simple things that can be done, including healthy lifestyle, smoking cessation, that can really help be preventative measures and that can allow patients to feel some empowerment that they do have some control over what's going on to some extent.
Great, thanks. And so, Dr. Kim, you mentioned the smoking cessation. You know, I think a lot of us that you know, aren't doctors, you know, understand why smoking is bad for, you know, for lungs and lung disease and lung cancer and all that. Why? How does smoking affect your eyes?
So, I think one of the biggest ways that smoking can affect your eyes, as it does many parts of your body, is that it's considered to create a lot of oxidative stress on the tissue, and oxidative stress is considered one of the major kind of starting mechanisms for macular degeneration. And so there really is just a wealth of data suggesting the role of oxidative stress, but also the role of smoking as a risk factor for macular degeneration. But having said that, there is still ongoing research trying to really further understand how smoking exactly affects macular degeneration. And I know that, in fact, I've seen some study that is currently ongoing from Massachusetts that the Bright Focus Foundation is funding. And so more work needs to be done, but it has to do with at least oxidative stress, but potentially other mechanisms as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. And you pointed out diet and exercise. I mean, do you have patients that ask you, like, is it too late? You know, if these are folks that are of a, you know, a little bit older, or their eyesight, you know, is starting to deteriorate. Like, is it, like, should somebody try to change that part of their life, you know, regardless of their age or vision condition?
Absolutely. I think that we should never feel like it's too late to live a healthier lifestyle. And not only would that have ramifications on that patient's entire health, but it can be beneficial at the eye. And I think we should never feel like it's too late, so to speak. I think it can only be helpful. And I encourage that for my patients when they ask me that question.
Thank you. We have a question from a listener wondering, are the different forms of geographic AMD that you mentioned, are any or all of these forms genetic? I mean, people worry about their children and their grandchildren. Is that a, should
right.
they be?
Right. So AMD and geographic atrophy as part of AMD are considered a complex disease. And what that means is that there are probably multiple factors that go into causing one patient to develop macular degeneration as opposed to another. And some of those risk factors are environmental. So, for example, we mentioned smoking and potentially the role of diet. But also there is a large literature showing genetic risk factors for macular degeneration. So people with certain gene variants have increased risk for macular degeneration. At the same time, not everyone with macular degeneration may have a genetic risk variant that's found or known. And so there is definitely a role for genetics, but exactly how still requires further research. We know that some genetic variants in the complement immune system pathway have been found and have led to some of the therapies that are up for potential approved therapies down the road for geographic atrophy. And so I will simply say that there is an important role for genetics, but it's not the whole picture.
Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate that. the distinctions there. And I want you to turn to the future of geographic atrophy treatments. I know you said a few minutes ago that you're encouraged, you see hope. I was wondering, why do you feel that way?
Right. So I think that many of us who've been following this field of geographic atrophy have felt that it's been a very long and difficult road to arrive at potential treatments. And so there actually is a long list of different therapeutics, different types of therapeutics that have been in clinical trials for geographic atrophy and actually have not worked. I also completed a phase 2 trial looking at a potent antioxidant called alpha lipoic acid. And this was a study funded in part by Bright Focus. And we had a clear reason to test this agent, but we found the therapy did not work. And so the drug development pathway has been challenging to the point that some people were starting to feel that geographic atrophy may be untreatable. But just not long ago, some really exciting things have been happening in the field with positive results from two phase 2 clinical trials that were both looking at what's called the complement pathway, which is a immune system pathway for the human body. And both studies had positive phase 2 results and are now in phase 3 clinical trials. And what that means is they're in the last phase, so to speak, for evaluation of the safety and efficacy. And if these trials work, then there could be an approved therapy for geographic atrophy. And I'm actually very optimistic about these drugs that are in the phase 3 studies.
Well, that's great. And I was wondering, how are these taking similar paths to a cure, or is there sort of a diversity of approaches that some of these take?
Right. So there are a lot of different approaches that are currently in clinical trials for geographic atrophy, and I can talk about a few of these. And so I'll go back first to the two drugs in clinical trials in phase 3 for the complement immune system pathway. And so this is a pathway of the immune system that's been highly implicated as a risk factor and has a strong relationship with macular degeneration. And there are two different drugs that are inhibiting different parts of that pathway. And both of them found somewhat similar results in their phase 2 trials. And the fact that these two independent trials had similar results, for me, gave me a lot of confidence that they really have the potential to work. And so these two drugs are in phase 3. And I would really say that these are studies that are worthwhile to consider enrolling in if you're a patient with geographic atrophy. There are some complexities with potential development of wet macular degeneration in some of the eyes in these studies, but these were caught early and wet AMD is treatable, whereas geographic atrophy still needs a treatment. And so I think that this is one approach that these two drugs are in the same class for that is something that's promising for geographic atrophy. Other approaches that have been taken are antioxidant therapies. And also, I know that there are various studies looking at stem cell approaches, and there are studies looking at modulating the visual cycle. And so there are different mechanisms that science has shown to play a role in geographic atrophy. They may be overlapping mechanisms. And so there's been a whole bag of approaches that people are trying, which gives us hope. It may be that down the road, more than one drug can be used at the same time to improve geographic atrophy for our patients.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I think that's it's interesting to see the different approaches that scientists are taking. And for all the ones you mentioned, you mentioned clinical trials several times. And I'd like to kind of turn to talk about clinical trials, because I think for most of us, clinical trials were this question that's on the bottom of the form when you're signing in at the doctor's office and you don't really know what it is and you just reflexively check no. And I think COVID has brought clinical trials into the forefront of the news. But you know, I still think it's one of those things everybody's heard of, but nobody understands. And so it's interesting to see how much of your vision research and your colleagues' vision research is done through clinical trials. So I was wondering if listeners are interested in learning more about clinical trials for macular degeneration, what should they do?
Well, I think that, first of all, there is some information available on the internet about clinical trials. And, it's, you know, for example, the clinicaltrials.gov website lists a lot of the clinical trials, and you're supposed to list the information about your trial on that website. So that provides some structured information. But I think that, you know, one of the more important ways for a patient to get information is, you know, if you have a doctor that you trust, to ask your doctor about the clinical trials that may be available and whether there is a trial that is relevant to you as a patient and whether you should consider enrolling in one of the studies. You know, clinical trials are really what has led to the drugs that we have today. So these treatments for wet AMD, which make a remarkable difference in the lives of these patients, they have only come to approval and they have only come for clinical use as standard of care treatments because of clinical trials and because of the patients that participated in those trials. And so regulated clinical trials are carefully monitored for both safety and efficacy parameters. And you know, I think it's something that patients can do to help contribute to the field of medicine. There's kind of this pay it forward aspect to trials where the drugs that we have now are only available to us because of prior patients that were willing to participate.
That's a great point. It really speaks to the selflessness and the sort of the citizenship that many people take in being a part of clinical trials. Now, for your patients, are there common questions or concerns that they may ask you about regarding clinical trials?
Right. So I think that a lot of the concerns about the trials for patients has to do with safety. And I think that it's important to ask those questions, first of all. I mean, it's your going to be your eye as a patient entering the study, and you're making a volunteer contribution to the study, and you deserve to know everything that you'd like to know about a trial that you might be entering. But, you know, clinical trials should have an independent safety monitoring committee that is overseeing the safety of the study, and they should already have many safety mechanisms in place to know what to do if there's any safety concern that develops for a patient enrolled in a trial. And so I think that patients should feel comforted and should know that clinical trials are carefully designed by experts. They go through regulatory oversight by the Food and Drug Administration to make sure that the safety parameters and the safety monitoring are in place for the studies. And I think that understanding that should allow the patients to have some comfort in enrolling. And I think that also it depends on the phase of the study. So just for general information for our patient audience, you know, there are phase one trials, which are earlier, you know, the first phase where a small group of patients is enrolling in a study to test a drug therapeutic, and your primary goal for that study is to look at safety parameters. And then drugs that pass that phase then go into phase two, where you're further understanding safety parameters, but also potentially looking at some effectiveness data. And then the drugs that have succeeded in phase two, then go to phase three, which is where you need success in that phase to potentially have an approved drug. And so particularly phase three trials, patients should have some comfort in the safety of the study and the potential efficacy of that drug. But all of the phases are important. All of them are carefully monitored for safety of the patients.
That's great. Thank you. And kind of related to that, I think most of us are aware that in a clinical trial, some people do not get the medicine that's being tested. They get a placebo. What do you say to patients that want to know if they're going to get a placebo, or want to know what if by not getting the medicine my vision gets worse? How does that work in a clinical trial setting?
Right. So first I'll say that especially in the stages of the clinical trials where you're looking to see if a drug works, really the best way to know is to compare patients that received the drug to those patients that did not receive the drug, and to make sure that both the investigators as well as the patients are not really knowledgeable about whether they got the drug or didn't get the drug, or if they received, for example, the placebo, because that's the way to get the best quality data. And then later, after the trial is completely done, then the two groups of patients, those receiving the drug and those receiving the placebo, can best be compared to really have a better understanding of whether the drug worked. And so this process called randomization, where a patient enters a study and then is not sure if they're getting the treatment or potentially a placebo, is critically important for us to really know, is a drug working? Now, that of course does mean that as a patient, perhaps as a patient really hoping to get a study drug, that you may not get it. But I think that the value of that contribution is incredibly important, and I just can't say enough about how that is really the pay it forward aspect of studies, where everyone has to kind of play the game appropriately and play the game fairly to get to the end, and then hopefully have a drug that is found to work and then reach approval.
Yeah, no, I think it's very well phrased, and I agree. We all have a shared goal of new and better treatments. And to our listeners, Bright Focus has a publication, a brochure called Clinical Trials: Your Questions Answered. It's free of charge, and it explains how trials work and some of the terms that Dr. Kim has mentioned, and some questions to ask your physician. So to anyone on this chat, if you'd like that mailed out to you free of charge, at the end of today's chat, we have a voicemail box, so you hear a tone. It can leave your name and U.S. mail address to get your free copy of Clinical Trials: Your Questions Answered. And one of the things that's in that publication is, should a patient expect to either have to pay to be on a clinical trial, or conversely, to get paid for a clinical trial? How does that tend to work?
Right. So, something that whether a patient is paid or gets paid is something that deserves scrutiny in clinical trials. So there are certainly clinical trials where a patient may not get any payment at all. And then there are other clinical trials where, and this is not uncommon, where there is some partial reimbursement to patients, which is really meant to cover their time and effort for actually participating, but is not supposed to be such a large amount that it creates some unfair bias towards the patient participating in the study. And these amounts of, payments to patients are carefully scrutinized by what are called institutional review boards, or, groups of a committee that reviews the safety and appropriateness of these types of aspects of clinical trials. As an example, there are some aspects where you can hear about trials where patients actually have paid to be part of a quote-unquote clinical trial, and some of these have been what have been touted as stem cell clinical trials, and there have been patients that have been paying more than several thousands of dollars to receive a stem cell treatment and to be considered a patient enrolled in a clinical study for stem cells for macular degeneration. And I would say that I would be highly cautious, and I really would beware any clinical trial where you as a patient are being required to pay someone to get into that study.
Well, no, it's a great concern, and I think it reinforces you know, I think what I've heard you mentioned several times today, just how important it is to have that conversation with your doctor and with your family and learn, you know, learn as much as you can. But yeah, it does sound like a great opportunity for people who often feel that a disease such as geographic atrophy is just, you know, can feel overwhelming, can feel pretty uphill at times to be a part of it. And you've given us a great sense of some of the drug development, opportunities that are in the pipeline. Just, you know, in the time we have left, are there other things about AMD besides drug development that where you feel like research is making some progress in the last couple of years?
There are. I think that something that we'd like to do is to find better ways to detect changes in the eye relevant to geographic atrophy, and there's a whole list of papers in this area of research, some of which again has been funded by Bright Focus, because the challenge in these trials is that these lesions of geographic atrophy, they expand at a relatively slow pace, and so it takes time to see whether a drug is actually affecting the growth rate of the lesion, because you have to wait to see how it's changing over time. And so one of the areas of research is looking into ways that we can kind of fine-tune our understanding or fine-tune our methods of looking for changes in geographic atrophy lesions, whether that's through imaging or functional tests for patients. And so that type of monitoring and further understanding how the lesions change and how that affects visual function is an important area of research. It's kind of referred to as looking for additional endpoints or trial outcomes for these clinical studies.
Well, that's great. And so for you, what's in your future? Where do you want to continue to go in AMD research?
Personally, one of my interests has been in the complement field for geographic atrophy, and I think that there are some interesting drugs, not only the ones that are currently in phase 3 clinical trials, but also other complement therapeutics that are in development, whether those are earlier phase clinical studies or preclinical studies. And so that's been one of my interests, and as someone that's primarily a clinician and someone that's involved in clinical trials, I've enjoyed collaborating with people that are scientists in the complement field.
Well, that's great. I appreciate it. So Dr. Kim, I just want to conclude by asking sort of a big picture question, your experience in the clinic and in the lab. Is there sort of a overarching lesson you learned, observation you've noticed, or piece of advice that you like to give patients and their families? Sort of a big picture final thought before we conclude for the day.
Sure. That's an interesting question. I think life these days feels incredibly complex on a day in, day out basis. And especially in the time of this COVID-19 pandemic, there's added complexity and challenges and many competing interests for our day as we go through it. I think we have to always remember that there's always an opportunity to try to make a positive impact on the world. And, you know, I think that many people often ask, what can I get out of something or what's in it for me? But perhaps we should always remember to ask and really prioritize the question of what can I do that would be helpful and that would make a positive impact on the world. And so I can say, at least for me, with all the competing interests in my life as I go through each day as an academician, you know, I try to always return to this idea of what brought me into this field, and which is to try to make a positive impact and to try to let that guide the decisions that I make.
Well, that's great. Dr. Kim, on behalf of Bright Focus and all of our listeners, I just wanted to thank you. I think you were very informative and very, very clear and easy to follow. And I think you gave a lot of very, very helpful advice. Just want to say thank you.
My pleasure. I appreciate it.
Well, great. So on behalf of Bright Focus Foundation, this concludes the November 2020 Bright Focus chat. And thanks and stay safe.
The information provided in this recording is a public service of Bright Focus Foundation and is not intended to constitute medical advice. Please consult your physician for personalized medical, dietary, and/or exercise advice. Any medications or supplements should only be taken under medical supervision. Bright Focus Foundation does not endorse any medical products or therapies.